Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. 2 weeks from today will be both Inauguration Day and Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Inaugurations are events rife with tradition, soaring rhetoric, and respect. Perhaps no one in 20th century history is more respected and reflected more inclusive, thoughtful views in his speechmaking than Martin Luther King Jr. By comparison, today is a less savory anniversary. It is 14 years to the day that President Bill Clinton's impeachment trial began in the U.S. Senate. It was the first time in more than a century that a president had faced an impeachment trial in the Senate. It was a major political event that captured the country's attention and was breathlessly covered moment by moment in ever more vitriolic language by the 24-hour cable news networks and syndicated talk radio. And in the 14 years since, well, it's safe to say our political discourse hasn't improved a great deal. What might it take to raise the level of discourse in our politics today? Can major issues and ideas really be debated respectfully and thoughtfully? And is it really so much worse today than it was 20 years ago, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years ago? As you contemplate those questions, I welcome our guest to today's discussion. John Murphy is Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Illinois. His research is focused on the history of American public address and political rhetoric, and he explores how political languages collide and influence each other throughout U.S. history. John Murphy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And as always, we welcome you to our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. What do you think? What would it take to raise the level of discourse in our country today? Do you find it harder and harder to engage in political discussions with family and friends? Have we lost some level of respect for opposing views? Or are our expectations too high for how politicians, pundits, and the public should relate to one another? And how has media, broadcast, print, online, social media influenced how we talk to one another about politics? Let us know what you think. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can post comments on that very same social media. We are on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. We're at Twitter at Will Public Media. And the phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Okay, so back in March, Andrew Rosenthal, in a New York Times editorial, asked whether we had hit rock bottom when it came to our political discourse. He has a specific example to cite. Set that aside for the moment. Have we reached a rock bottom?
We have not hit rock bottom. we have a long way to go. No, I didn't mean it quite that way. There are cycles in American history, I think it's fair to say. And there are cycles in how we talk with one another and to one another. And historians, rhetorical critics, most of us believe that 1800, for instance, was one of the worst elections, if not the worst election in American history. And that's partly because 1800 was the moment between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams when we changed political administrations for the first time. The Federalist Party controlled the administration until that point. Jefferson took over in 1800, and the Democrat-Republican Party took over. And so that initial moment when we had to make room for political opposition, we didn't have a good idea what a loyal opposition was at that moment in our history. And that election was enormously controversial. Jefferson was accused of all kinds of things that we know now he did. And Adams was accused of wanting a monarchy, of being a king, of overriding the will of the people. It was a hostile, nasty election with charges of traitor all over the place. And so, no, I don't think we've hit rock bottom necessarily.
But I could imagine folks thinking, well, 1800 is 1800 and 2013 is 2013. Mm-hmm. And the construct of the world in which we live is different today than it was in 1800.
Oh, it certainly is. And it means we have a different kind of discourse. And the biggest difference, I would think, between then and now is the creation of simultaneous public address. And by that, I mean we experience speech in real time now. In 1800, they didn't. It had to be printed in a newspaper, sent throughout a country. But if President Obama gives a speech today, we all experience it as one audience in the same moment. And we can all react to it as one audience in the same moment, doing those same things. And that makes for a different kind of speaking experience. If we want to think about rock bottom in recent years, most people regard 1988 as one of the worst elections that we've had in recent years. George H.W. Bush versus Michael Dukakis, in which the Willie Horton ad, which used racial appeals to try to code the Democratic Party as soft on crime, and all kinds of things went on in that election. In fact, A number of Bush's people, particularly Lee Atwater, later apologized for the kinds of things they did in that election. So 1988 was in fact, there was a cover of Time magazine which had a picture of the 1960 presidential debates with the headline, 1988, you're no 1960. And given that headline, most people were quite discouraged about the state of our politics then.
But I guess I wonder if we can make a distinction between the level of vitriol in political discourse at the presidential election level mm-hmm. among those supporting one politician or another, and the day-to-day invective that we hear, not just from politicians and not just from pundits, but from each other.
Oh, I think that's true. One of the things that's true is we also go through periods in history where our political identity is more or less wrapped up with our entire identity. And there are times in our history, say the 1950s, when most people didn't immediately identify as Republican or Democrat. If I said, Craig, who are you? Your response might be something like, I work at WILO. I am a Baptist. I am this. I am that. It wouldn't be I am a Republican or I am a Democrat being at the top of how you would inventory yourself.
Right.
And that was probably true in the 1950s. But in the late 19th century, and I think today, we tend to be much more aware of the political identity of those we are around. We think of ourselves as Democrats or Republicans much more highly on that list. And I think that's a result of the polarization, the partisan nature of our era. And that leads us to talk hostily to each other in a number of kinds of ways.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing political discourse and what it might take to raise it in an ever more divided political society. My guest is John Murphy. He's Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Illinois, and his research is focused on the history of American public address and political rhetoric. And we welcome your thoughts this morning. What would it take to raise the level of discourse in our country today? Do you find it harder and harder to engage in political discussions with family and friends? Have we lost respect for opposing views? Let us know what you think. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I want to cite more specifically the example that led to Andrew Rosenthal to write that op-ed in the New York mm-hmm. Times that I was referring to. And he cited a number of examples in the article that are frankly so outrageous they're probably not worth repeating in public. But I am going to mention one just to cite an example. And it was Rush Limbaugh's characterization of Georgetown law student Sandra Fluke, who criticized her school's refusal to provide insurance for contraceptives, as a slut. And that was back in mm-hmm. March of 2012. It almost, I don't think the word quaint is right, but it almost feels somewhat more innocent when you compare that to the rest of the rhetoric that we heard throughout the election campaign. We heard some really nasty things back and forth. Are you sure that 1988 was nastier?
That's a tough example to say, and I'll grant you that one certainly. Part of what's true is that the discourse has also gotten worse as it has become profitable to do that. When you start to wrap political discourse and political commentary up with the profit motive, as we see on talk radio shows, as we see in networks, Fox, MSNBC, who draw viewers and make money by doing those kinds of things, that starts to make it more difficult, because it didn't used to be that political speech made you money. You couldn't make a living off of commenting on politics. That was not really the case throughout a good deal of American history. There were newspaper editors and so forth, but they had to have a much larger sense of, you know, I'm running a newspaper, I need to provide this kind of information as well, these other kinds of things. What has happened, I think, over the past couple of decades is that with talk radio, with talk television, we've begun to figure out that we can draw ears and eyes by doing this sort of thing. And that gives you an incentive. That makes it part of your own self-interest to be as outrageous as possible. And that, I think, is a problem that is relatively new on the political landscape. And it's a difficult one to solve because you can't really stop that in some ways.
I imagine some of those purveyors of that sort of language and approach would say, no, I'm just reflecting the society at large. Maybe it's a little bit hyper-realized for entertainment value, but if my speech seems coarse or extreme or intense, it's because that's how people who hold my views feel about this given issue that's so important.
We don't often hear the word slut in everyday life, I don't think.
Well, that's... you're throwing my example back in my face, yeah. Fair enough.
Most often, people don't in seriousness. I mean, they may joke about it. And even the jokes don't work anymore, really. That's a term that starts to fall outside the bounds. And that's why I think people reacted to it so strongly.
Okay, then how coarse is the language in our politics today?
I think in some ways it's actually less coarse than it used to be, partly because we have grown much more careful about various kinds of words we use to treat minorities in our society, to treat our fellow citizens. Humor is a good example. We don't tell the kinds of jokes that were told in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s. We simply don't do it. We've got a sense that somehow we're more coarse now, but if you look at some of the things people actually said in public and some of the language they used in those eras, it was terrible. And a lot of that has to do with a more inclusive society where we are more willing to treat minorities as fellow citizens.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we welcome your questions and comments for John Murphy. He's an associate professor of communication at the University of Illinois. We're discussing political discourse in America today, and whether we're talking about the pension debate in Springfield or the fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington the last few weeks, in our politics, in media, and in our own conversations about the issues of the day, are we communicating effectively and respectfully with one another, or has our political discourse coarsened to a point that it's hard to engage on the issues that matter to us? We welcome your thoughts and any questions you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. We're on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. And those phone numbers again are 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we'll begin this morning with Mike in Effingham. Good morning, Mike.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What I'm about to say is generalized, and the question is surrounded by demonization. And where the good guys and the bad guys, and how that has evolved over time since the aggressive males seized power and have organized society under that paradigm of good guys, bad guys, and the demonization, which is conversational dialectic. If your guests could address that, I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It's an interesting concept that maybe we've just – it's easier to structure the world as good versus evil.
And our language tends to lead us in that direction. One of the things that linguists know is that the English language in particular, we tend to find it easier to talk about pairs than we do to talk about a continuum. So even take the word good and bad. What's in the middle? You know, mediocre,
okay.
These are not words, you know, that express much, that have much vivacity or color. We don't use them all that much. Old and young, middle-aged, kind of hyphen in the middle. There's not a real sense of the middle quite often, especially in our political language, Republicans versus Democrats. We've got a structural system in place. Because of the winner-take-all nature of our congressional districts, of our Senate voting, of our presidential voting with the Electoral College, that really only allows for two parties. You are, in effect, wasting your vote if you vote for a third party. And that leads us then to have a kind of confrontative demonization, as the caller said, of good versus bad or of us versus them. Within that. And it's not, I don't want to be a language determinist, but there's also a sense that we know very well that people who cannot unite for any other reason tend to unite on the basis of a common enemy. Winston Churchill once famously said that he would have, you know, supper with Joseph Stalin, if, with the devil. He would sup with the devil if he would help him to oppose Adolf Hitler. And we tend to look at our politics sometimes that way as well.
Let's go next to Deborah in Urbana. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. When Harold Washington was elected mayor of Chicago, I recall that there were some terrible, terrible things said. And the animosity and acrimonies continued in his battles with the city council. The language was, I know it was difficult for Chicago getting off of the from Daley to Blandick to Jane Byrne. If you could address maybe some of the dialogue that took place in Chicago around that time, during that era.
Sure. I'm not as familiar with that as I might be with other instances. But part of what we know about the Harold Washington years, and it just brings up an issue we all find it very difficult to talk about, which is race. Harold Washington was the first black mayor of Chicago, and it was not only simply race, but it was also a conflict of interests. He represented a coalition that had long been left out of a good deal of Chicago politics. And so when you combine those two things, the stakes were high. And people were not used to the idea of being led by an African-American mayor. So between those two things, you're going to get a great deal of vitriol. Pioneers generally face vitriol. And we've seen that again and again in American history. They're usually abused, made fun of, laughed at, scorned. And then when pioneers become, I don't want to term it a threat, but have the ability to gain power, when they get close to power, as Washington did, or gain that power, as Washington did, then that simply heightens the stakes and makes the vitriol go even higher.
You earlier referred to this notion of vitriol in our politics being cyclical. What causes those cycles?
I don't think anybody's exactly sure. I've always had a little bit of a theory that we actually tend to pick on each other more and become more angry in the wake of traumatic events. And so politics in the late 19th century after the Civil War was often terribly difficult, with people calling each other awful names and party identity being very high. And we talk about the Clinton impeachment or the 1988 campaign, both of those taking place in the context of the Cold War coming to an end, that we had lived under enormous tension, strain, effort for a couple of decades. And as that came to an end, we tended to turn internal and tended to turn on each other a little bit more.
Can we look at contemporary world events of the last 20 years and say, well, there have been perhaps more traumatic events, more significant events, or we are more aware of them than we were in the past, so that's creating either more of these cycles or an endless sort of period of more intense speech?
It may be that we're more aware of them, but I don't think we can underestimate the sheer material misery caused by the great collapse of 2008. Because we lived through it, we tend to look at historical events and say, oh, that must have been awful to live through. I can't imagine having lived through that. The Great Depression or the crash of the stock market or the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We ourselves tend to discount a little bit things like a financial crisis because it sort of unfolded over several months, and because we ourselves lived through it, it can't be as bad as historical events. And it turns out it was pretty bad. And there's still a hangover to that. And I think a lot of the anger that we have about that is still out there.
Can we look at events like September 11th, 2001, the response to it, and then say, okay, well, during that period, there was a period of time where there was sort of a sense of coming together, but then it was followed by some very intense debate.
And again, part of that got caught up in the politics of the time, particularly the midterm elections of 2002, in which there were people who used patriotism as a blunt tool to try to elect others or get others out of office. The best example being a Vietnam veteran, former Senator Max Cleland of Georgia, being driven from office with a terrible campaign in Georgia, just an awful campaign, attacking his patriotism. He's a man who lost both legs and one arm. And at that point, you just do kind of wonder about what's going on.
I wonder, I know that all of the statements that we've made to this point dealing with the cyclical nature and various trends associated with, a more intense dialogue that we have on certain issues, all that aside, technology has to play a role to some degree in all of this.
Oh, I think it does. A good deal of that is involved with, we've talked several times about how could things improve a little bit? What could we do? One thing I think, we tend to put all of the responsibility on politicians. Why can't you speak better? Why can't you lead better? Why can't you speak as Dr. King spoke? Why can't you do that? Some of the responsibility also rests on us. We need to listen better. One of the things I've noted from students, for instance, in my class, who spend a lot of time on Twitter, who like technology, who've lived through No Child Left Behind and a different way of teaching that they are taught to the test, is that they have a difficult time listening to what somebody says and understanding what is said in a speech and what's going on because they are constantly anticipating what they are supposed to say about it. And I think a lot of us have that. We see something go up on Twitter and we don't think about what they're saying. We think, how can I respond to that? How can I top that? How can I be more clever? How can I be more fun? How can how can I be the one who gets the attention? And the same with Facebook posts, the same with social media in a variety of kinds of ways. And in politics, it tends to be we listen in order to attack. And so even as somebody is saying something, we're thinking of the things we can say in response to them to really stick it to them, to really get to them. And I've even noticed this among my students. We need to be much better about listening to what somebody actually says, to the evidence and arguments that they use, while not thinking about how we're going to respond to that. Just listen to it.
And that gets to another question that I threw out to our listeners, I want to throw out to you, which is, have we lost respect for that opposing view?
I think we have to a certain extent. And again, it's cyclical. We've gone through that before in our history. But there's a powerful lack of respect that exists out there. And I'm not sure, and part of it does come from simply not being willing to think carefully about what somebody else says. Part of it also comes, I think, as well, because of the enormous amount of information we're all asked to deal with. And I think that's a complex phenomenon, but a good deal of it involves, I can't read everything, so I'm just going to go with my gut. And going with your gut's not always the smartest thing to do. I went with my gut a lot in college and made some pretty stupid decisions. and so I think just going with your gut maybe is not what you want to do all of the time. And yet there just seems to be so much. Who can I trust? Every day your inbox can be filled with somebody saying, this study is true. No, it's wrong. No, that's a Facebook meme. Don't believe that. All of that kind of thing is out there. So it becomes difficult. If you can't figure out what's good information, then you just have a tendency to toss all information out the window and say, to heck with it, I'm just going to do what I believe.
And so then we end up in conversations where everyone's arguing what their gut tells them must be right, rather than dealing with facts and forming opinions based off of those facts.
Yeah, or even having a common reality that we can participate in. So we agree we're going to argue about this, and we know what this is, and we're able to understand this. And that gets to be pretty difficult.
We have an email from Jeff in Urbana, and he asks if you would be willing to discuss any of the research that has been done regarding motivated reasoning in politics and how it might affect or interfere with the ability to communicate clearly with each other on political topics. He says he's most familiar with the phenomenon thanks to Chris C. Mooney. I don't know who that is, but he's a popularizer rather than an original researcher.
I'm not quite sure what he means by motivated reasoning, but there is a considerable body of research out there I'm familiar with that tends to say if people have a stake in something, they are more likely to research it, to pay attention to it, to know about it. To do that. For instance, Senator Mark Kirk, bless him, recently returned to the U.S. Senate after an enormous amount of effort. And he deserves applause from everybody for what he has done and what he has been through. But he did note when he got there that he's going to start paying much more attention in terms of Medicare and Medicaid to therapy for stroke victims because of what he has been through. That's a sense in which somebody has been through an experience and they are now motivated. They understand what public policy may affect them. Similarly, former Vice President Cheney, his daughter is gay, and he supports gay marriage. Now, you wouldn't normally think Dick Cheney would support gay marriage, given his other political beliefs. But because his daughter is gay and is married, he tends to support that. So we have a tendency to notice things in our immediate world when we're motivated to do it. The difficulty becomes how to step outside of our comfort zone, how to notice and care about things that aren't immediately relevant or apparent to us. And that's a skill that needs to be developed.
I want to talk some more about this notion of how we can improve our discourse, but get beyond the questions of hateful language versus respect, and talk about some of the other qualities that go into soaring rhetoric, high quality discourse, that sort of thing. But a reminder first, this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we welcome your questions and comments this morning for John Murphy. He's Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Illinois. We are discussing political discourse in America today, whether we're talking about the pension debate in Springfield or the fiscal cliff negotiations in Washington, in our politics and media, and in our own conversations about the issues of the day. How are we communicating with one another? Has our political discourse coarsened to a point that it's hard to engage on the issues that matter to us? Let us know what you think at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And it's time for a short break. This is Focus.
At long last, season 3 of Downton Abbey is here.
I'm so looking forward to seeing your mother again. When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with creator and writer Julian Fellows. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal in Champaign. Eastern Rug Gallery offers professional cleaning and repair service for Oriental and other handmade rugs, and provides repair and restoration services for fringe and sides, holes, rips, and animal stains.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with University of Illinois Associate Professor of Communication John Murphy about political discourse. He studies the history of American public address and political rhetoric, and you can join us on air by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have an email from Rowana who asks, how much does the shift in access to information affect this kind of negative discourse? She says, I remember from reading some discussion that the invention of the printing press 600 years ago also precipitated a period of time of serious vitriol against politicians and state leaders.
I think it's the different ways we get information, and as I said earlier, the amount of information or to some extent disinformation. There's that famous old quotation, I think it's from Mark Twain, that a lie is able to circle the world while the truth is still putting on its pants. there's a powerful sense in which, as we all have experienced on Facebook or on websites or in social media, of hoaxes, of stuff that goes around, you can't believe he said that. Well, it turns out he didn't say that. And it becomes very easy for that stuff to spread and spread quickly, and very difficult then, because of the nature of the web and of social media, to get a retraction. I mean, if the New York Times makes a mistake, they can publish a retraction. It's there in the Times you see it. If I accidentally post something, maybe I can post a retraction, but I might not even know about it. And all the people who saw it might not see it, and it's out there and it's floating everywhere. So it's a different world in terms of that kind of misinformation.
I'm going to quote someone now. Mario Cuomo is credited for saying, and I've heard others say it, Bill Clinton among them, that politicians campaign in poetry and govern in prose. Are we missing some poetry today?
I have to say that there is no one in my experience that's more true of than our current president. Barack Obama in 2008 gave some absolutely gorgeous campaign speeches, some of the best rhetoric we have heard in recent years. His speech after he lost the New Hampshire primary, his race speech in Philadelphia, and especially the election night speech in Grant Park, which is one of my favorites. It's an absolutely gorgeous speech. And then that just kind of disappeared. And he truly did govern in prose after that. And it became very problem solution and very technical quite often. And I'm not quite sure where the Barack Obama of 2008 went. And so we could use some of that poetry. I think with his inaugural, with his State of the Union coming up, I hope President Obama rediscovers his poetic sense and gives us some more of that.
Is that onus on presidents? Is that onus on politicians? Or is it on all of us to be better in effectively communicating our points of view? Not just in terms of respect, but in terms of making use of the right words in the right way, in the right context, and being more thoughtful in the words we use.
Yeah, I think it's on all of us. And there are sort of two levels to that. One is that, especially as a teacher, I get particularly cranky about students who are used to social media or used to 140 characters, and I would like them to write in English sentences. I would like periods and commas. I think those are useful things.
You're asking a lot there.
I'm asking a lot there, but frankly, I would like an exclamation point now and then. And so there's that level where we start to wonder whether basic writing skills and the use of the right word in the right place and being able to edit and take the time and write more than one draft comes into play. But there's a second level in which eloquence most often, at least in my view, tends to reflect an ability to understand the experience of others and bring it into your speech. One of the most amazing speeches in American history is Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural. And for those of you who have seen the movie Lincoln, it occurs near the very end. You see Daniel Day-Lewis at the second inaugural saying, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this scourge of war may speedily pass away." It's a small poem within an inaugural that is a large poem. But what's most striking about that inaugural is his ability to account for the experiences of all Americans, North and South, to recreate the experience of the war and to argue that these are the judgments of the Lord, that the sacrifice we have undergone is not partisan, it is not on one side or the other, that it is something beyond our understanding. And very few presidents have spoken of mystery like that. And so that's, this ability to sort of reach out and account for experiences we don't often think about or peoples we don't notice is an extraordinary ability.
Why do you think there aren't more people that at least search for, attempt to reach that level of rhetoric and eloquence?
Well, for one thing, most of us naturally care about what's near and dear to us. And I am not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, all of us are going to care a great deal about our family, our wives, our children. But in another sense, that's not often rewarded in the system. One of the things that was true about Mitt Romney's 47% remark in the middle of the election is that was a cold, clear calculation. He did not believe that he could get the votes of those 47%, so it was not worth addressing them. The difficulty with that as a president, you have to talk to everybody, even those who do not support you. And even in a campaign, you hope that candidates will try to include everybody, because to be president is to be president of all of the people, not some of the people. But the thing is, the system doesn't build in rewards for doing that. It takes an extra effort, instrumental rewards. I mean, it's hard to get elected doing that. Constantly trying to bring in the opinions of others. And it's quite controversial. And so that gets hard to do.
Let's let politicians off the hook for a second.
Sure.
Just briefly, and then they're back on it. Do you find personally that it is harder and harder to engage in political discussions with family and friends today compared to 20 years ago?
It's hard to say because, at least in my experience, Facebook has been a revolution for that. I've often been able to talk to my friends and family, but Facebook, in a sense, offers you the opportunity to speak to a much wider group of people. And I'm sure many in the listening to us have had the experience over this past election. We're high school friends who probably don't share your political views or others are on your Facebook page. And you really need to engage arguments in a way, perhaps, that, at least for me, that I had not done before. And so that was a challenge. There were times when I think I rose to the challenge, when I carefully considered what they had to say, where we engage each other, where we're doing it respectfully. And then there are times when I'm tired or cranky, and one of the great things about a computer is you can click send and or click post, and bang, there it is. And that's one of the awful things as well. And I didn't quite rise to the challenge. So I think you know, part of what Facebook does is allow us to connect with a much wider variety of people, perhaps, than we might normally have done in everyday conversation. That presents new challenges.
I'm reminded of a comment that John Stewart made in recent years about social media. He says he asks himself three questions before posting anything. He says, does this need to be said? Does this need to be said by me? And does this need to be said by me now?
Those are great questions.
They are.
Particularly the middle one. All of us, because we all have a little bit of egotistical in us, tend to think that our contribution is unique and amazing, and all other contributions pale in comparison. And sometimes we need to have a sense of humility about that.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your questions or comments for University of Illinois Associate Professor John Murphy at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. So what else might it take to raise the level of discourse in our politics today and define level however you want?
I think it's also going to take our willingness to read, to see a variety of points of view, to expose ourselves to a lot of discourse. President Obama, regardless of what you think of his politics, is an eloquent guy when he chooses to be. That's partly because he loves language. It's clear in the memoir he wrote before he even thought about politics and Dreams from My Father that he likes to read, that he likes to play with language. And our best presidential orators, to use one example, and our best orators in general, have generally been people who like to read good books, who like to listen to other speeches. We know that's true of Abraham Lincoln. We know that's true of Ronald Reagan. We know it's true of John Kennedy. John Kennedy used to listen carefully to Winston Churchill, listen to recordings of Churchill speaking, because he was so fascinated by how he used rhythm and how he used metaphor in his speeches. And so part of what we need to do is to realize speechmaking is not somehow this great gift that clouds open up, a sunbeam comes down, and you are marvelously transported into being Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr. began giving sermons at the age of 12. He spoke nearly every week, at least once a week, sometimes two or three times a week, for the rest of his life. It is an art, public speaking is, but it's also a craft, and you need to work at it. You need to read other speakers. You need to understand what other people say. You need to have stuff available in your head. King knew his Bible inside and out, and he could bring the resources of the King James Bible to bear on almost every issue.
Does that sort of eloquence move the needle? Does it influence people?
Because the best analogy here is to sports. In almost any sport, take college football, for instance, the spread offense is becoming a big deal. Everybody wants to use it. Everybody wants a running quarterback. More and more teams start to imitate that. Success breeds imitation. King bred imitation. Now, some of it was pretty bad. For a couple of decades there, almost every speech ended with, you know, King began with, "I have a dream," and so we got, "I hope for an America, I hope for a nation, I dream a dream," where you had these kinds of phrases that after a while, they became cliche. But nonetheless, there was a general pulling up where they sought to imitate the kind of eloquence that King represented. And that, I think, is important. It's useful.
Are there other figures from American history and politics or outside of it that maybe we don't think about automatically? People who were particularly eloquent, particularly effective at communicating ideas, concepts, and moving people's opinions?
I like to think about those people who faced enormous obstacles. And let me give two small examples. On PBS, on WILL tomorrow night, The American Experience is going to deal with the abolitionists and offer a special on that. And they faced enormous obstacles. Nobody believed at that time in our history, frankly, that African Americans were fully human. And to make that argument in the midst of the cultural consensus that they were all wrong, was an extraordinary achievement. And Frederick Douglass's the famous speech, What to a Slave is the Fourth of July, is one of the great texts of American history. Similarly, those arguing for woman suffrage in the 19th century, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, these were women who faced tremendous obstacles and had to be enormously inventive in their public discourse to overcome the anger, the scorn, the humiliation that was heaped upon them. So I often, when I want to think of eloquence, I look for very tough situations. The tougher the situation, the more likely you're going to get an eloquent speaker trying to overcome that.
So we've talked about eloquence and we've talked about respect. What are some other qualities that make up a particularly effective communicator, particularly in the political landscape?
The ability to grasp facts, understand them, and present them in ways people can understand. And the best example of that in recent American history is Bill Clinton. There is nobody who was able to take information, to take facts, and translate it into digestible chunks for an audience. His speech at the Democratic National Convention this past August was simply marvelous for that. He was able to take information, to cite sources, to cite statistics, and use them in ways that people went, oh, okay, that's what's going on. I get that. And most often information can confuse people. Most often statistics bore them. Clinton has a way of presenting them as part of a larger narrative that makes sense to people, and he can explain them beautifully. In fact, President Obama often referred to him as the explainer-in-chief after that moment. And Clinton has always had that talent.
Is there anybody out there that has shown themselves to be capable of all three of those major concepts?
Oh, that's kind of tough. And that, again, tends to come out of particular moments at particular times. When we talked about 9/11 earlier, the Oklahoma City bombing, Bill Clinton's speech after the Oklahoma City bombing, his speech at the memorial service in Oklahoma is a beautiful use of both eloquence, of language, of cultural resources, drawing on the Bible, drawing on other sources. It's a marvelous speech.
Well, it kind of sounds like what we're talking about is that raising discourse in our politics has to do with speaking to people's emotions in a respectful way and speaking to their analytical minds in a thoughtful way.
Speaking to the whole person and respecting people as whole people. A phrase that's sometimes bandied about is that we want people who will speak to us as if we are adults. And I think that's a useful phrase in some ways because we seek language, we seek leadership, we seek orators, or we should, I think, who speak to us as a whole person, who understand that we feel, that we see, that we think, that we have faith, that we're spiritual creatures, that we speak to us as a whole person. And the best oratory, I think, does that. It recognizes the humanity of the audience and speaks to that humanity.
Why does it seem we have so many who speak to the least of us or at least their speech suggests that they are not respecting us as an audience?
Because I think power is a powerful attractor, and it is often easy to gain power by treating other people as instruments, as tools. And demagogic oratory, the worst of oratory, tends to treat the audience merely as tools, as instruments to be used to gain yet more power. And that's the kind of thing we need to fear, I think, the most. It's certainly the thing the founders feared the most.
We have just a few minutes left, but there is still time for your questions or comments for University of Illinois Associate Professor of Communication John Murphy. He studies the history of American public address and political rhetoric, and we're discussing America's political discourse. And we welcome your calls at 333-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have one email. Individual says, we're missing one of the most obvious reasons for our lowly discourse. He says, the lack of backbone amongst academics. The pension fiasco is a good example. This person says, I don't know how many times I've heard officials from CSRS say the fund is in good shape with no objection from the finance professors at the U of I. Without their input, the discourse is doomed to be mediocre.
As an academic, I'm inclined to defend us. But in a larger sense, I think that the email addresses the role of experts in public debate and what we expect experts to do. And Americans have traditionally been of two minds about experts. One, such as the person who emailed in, believes that experts, academics in this case, have particular skills, ability, knowledge to bring to public debate. And the flip side of that tends to be, well, we're deeply afraid that somehow bureaucrats or technocrats are going to take over our society. And so the American public has always been sort of two minds, very divided about the role of expertise of intellectuals in public life.
Can major issues and ideas be debated respectfully and thoughtfully in our political system today?
I think they can. I'm going to be very interested to see how the debate over gun control evolves over the next several weeks, because I think that is going to be a test of whether we're able to do that. I think there's a big stake on the part of a lot of people in this debate, and the president seems very determined to forward that debate, and that's a hard debate to have, so it'll be a test.
Let's go next to Marlene in Urbana. Hi, Marlene.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering what the speaker thought of the polarization in theology areas that we are having these days, and how that reflects speeches and how topics are approached, mainly from the standpoint of taking the whole human into consideration, as you were speaking before. And I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
All right, thanks for the call.
Hi, Marlene. I think there are two things I'd say in response to that. One is that there has been a steady rise over the past 15 to 20 years in biblical references in presidential speeches. If you actually look at Ronald Reagan's speeches, he didn't cite the Bible all that much. Whereas you often see biblical citations from Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. I sometimes worry that our theology is becoming as divided as our politics. That on the one hand, we have a kind of theological vision that comes from Martin Luther King, Bill Clinton through Barack Obama, which is a progressive, non-literal reading of the Bible that believes we should be ever more inclusive, that draws on the words of the Apostle Paul saying that all should come, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, et cetera, versus a kind of more literal reading of the Bible that says there are fundamental principles on which we stand and that these principles endure throughout time and space, and to depart from those principles is to violate the will of God, and when societies do that, they fall. And that has generally worked through a more conservative discourse of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush and some others. And so in that sense, I worry that our theology starts to get as divided as our politics, and our spirituality ought to be one ground, at least, on which we can find some common ground.
And we'll go next to Eric in Urbana. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Giving a good speech is one thing, but backing it up is another. President Obama gives a good speech, but take gun control. He has done nothing, given a few words regarding the illegality of the assault weapons and the high magazine gun clips. But he's done next to nothing in that regard. Take the Florida politicians, their Stand Your Ground statute. That's a very poorly named statute. It should have been named Last Resort, when there's no other course and you fear grave bodily injury, then you have a right to use a gun, rather than if somebody bumps into you, instead of a fist fight, if you're both armed, then it can be a gunfight. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. So sometimes there's language, but if the given individual expressing that eloquent language doesn't back it up, then there's a disconnect.
This is one of those grounds. I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree with the caller a little bit here. This is one of those grounds that I hear a lot, and the evidence is pretty clear. In fact, Tracy Sulkin, who's a political science professor here at the University of Illinois, has written a book noting that congressional candidates generally keep their campaign promises. They don't always succeed, but they try. They pass the legislation they claim they're going to do. And in a broader sense, if you look at the past several presidents, if you look at their campaign speeches, you've got a pretty good idea of what they're going to do in office, and they generally followed up on that. Now, I think with gun control, that was low down on Obama's priority list, and I suspect over the next month or so we're going to figure out whether he really is going to back that up or make an effort in that direction.
Is expressing language in and of itself a demonstration of doing something about a given issue?
Absolutely. There was my advisor and a colleague of hers wrote a famous book called Deeds Done in Words. That is, words are deeds. We have a tendency in our culture to talk about, you know, talking the talk and walking the walk, and that words are not deeds. Words often are deeds. Not all the time, but words often are deeds. And so in that sense, expressing commitment, expressing solidarity is precisely what people are looking for from their politicians. At the same time, we also look for policy change. And I think a lot of the time we do get that policy change.
And I imagine in some cases people will look for different things from different kinds of politicians. You look to a lawmaker to make laws. You might look to someone in an executive function to lead in terms of a vision, but not necessarily to be pushing specific legislation.
Yeah. I mean, different areas require different things from politicians. For instance, we tend to look to congressional leadership to get things done. Generally, congressional leaders, the Senate Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, are not particularly eloquent people. They never have been. That's why they hardly ever become President of the United States. They're simply not. They're mechanics. They figure out how to get legislation through the Congress. Whereas we expect, as George H.W. Bush famously put it, the vision thing from our presidents.
All right. And at the risk of putting things in either one box or another, are you generally optimistic or pessimistic about our political discourse in the coming years?
I am a little bit pessimistic in the near short term. I think we've got some very difficult issues to deal with. I think in the longer term, I am quite optimistic. I think that we're going to do well.
John Murphy is Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Illinois. His research is focused on the history of American public address and political rhetoric, and he explores how political languages collide and influence each other throughout U.S. history. John Murphy, thanks for talking with us today.
It was a pleasure to be here.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anybody who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream this program live every day on that website, will.illinois.edu. You can listen back to past programs. The program Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. On tomorrow's show, we will turn our attention to the major subject at hand right now at the State House in Springfield, Illinois' pension debt. We'll discuss the history of and issues surrounding it. We'll talk about how our state found its way into such a massive debt obligation, some of the issues lawmakers are working through right now, and what might ultimately be the best way forward to meet that debt and sustain the state's pension system. That's on tomorrow's show. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Today, we also welcome on board our new Focus producer, Lindsay Moon. Welcome, Lindsay. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.